Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's "When did you stop beating your wife?" defense of his mental health in response to the revelations in Michael Wolff's book, with Trump's claim that he is a very stable genius, and speak with a prominent psychiatrist who has been lobbying Capitol Hill, urging lawmakers to act on the dangers posed by a president exhibiting manifest signs of psychological frailty under ordinary circumstances, who, under stress, could cause catastrophic damage to the country and the world. Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist at the Yale School of Medicine, who was the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference and the editor of the bestseller, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, joins us to discuss her warning that the personal health of public figures is their private affair until, that is, it becomes a threat to public health. And her article at The Guardian, "Trump is Now Dangerous, That Makes His Mental Health a Matter of Public Interest." Then we'll speak with Sarah Kendzior, a journalist who specializes in the authoritarian states of Central Asia and is an op-ed columnist for the Toronto Globe and Mail. She joins us to discuss the sudden about-face of Senator Lindsey Graham, who went from being an acerbic critic of Trump to a gushing sycophant, and her concern that Trump is following the playbook of his mentor, Roy Cohn, and is possibly blackmailing Lindsey Graham using information the Russians hacked from the RNC and the senator's private email. Then finally, we'll look further into the extent to which Republican leaders have thrown their lot in with Trump and are now actively colluding in a purge of the DOJ and the FBI following Speaker Paul Ryan's decision to back the highly partisan White House flunky House Intelligence Chairman Devin Nunes' sabotage of the Mueller investigation by subpoenaing FBI documents that are evidence in the ongoing Russian probe, which will surely end up in Trump's hands and cripple Mueller's inquiry. Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security, joins us. And joining us now is Dr. Bandy Lee, a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine, who served as director of research for the Center for the Study of Violence, co-founded Yale's Violence and Health Study Group, and leads an academic collaborators group for the World Health Organization. She's the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited, emerged. And she has an article at The Guardian, "Trump is Now Dangerous, That Makes His Mental Health a Matter of Public Interest." Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Bandy Lee.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Doctor. And the Michael Wolff revelations, in which are getting a lot of attention, dominating the news at the moment, in spite of Donald Trump's claim that he is a genius, a very stable genius. The book reveals an extraordinary catalog of indications that Donald Trump is not mentally fit to be president of the United States, or I'm not perhaps even dog catcher of the United States if there was such an office. But there seems to be an inherent problem in the way our founding fathers, you know, structured the Constitution. If the American people make a terrible mistake and elect the wrong leader, the mechanisms to get rid of him are there, but they're not that easy to access, and we're clearly finding that out now. But when you contrast that to the damage that this incumbent can do with unfettered access to the nuclear button, that seems to me like the ultimate recipe for disaster.
Yes, you're right. First of all, before I make any more comments, could I make a few disclaimers?
Sure.
The first is that I'm speaking on my own behalf and not representing the views of my institutions, that is Yale University, Yale School of Medicine, and Yale Department of Psychiatry. Secondly, I have to clarify that the conference that I organized on the subject of whether or not there's a duty to warn when a public figure is involved, it has been called Duty to Warn Conference, but it should be distinguished from the organization duty to warn, which is a non-professional political group. Thirdly, I wish to make clear that I'm not lobbying Congress and I don't reach out to legislators myself. Rather, I am available to them as a medical expert. So I just wish to make those clear. I hope that's okay.
Well, I'm glad you did. But who is this group then, this duty to warn group that you mentioned that have nothing to do with you?
Oh, yes. Actually, many of us initially were mistaken in believing it was a professionals group. But it turned out to be mostly non-professionals and, in fact, formed a political action committee and is advocating on the behalf of the Democratic Party, and so has given donations, awards, and reached out to legislators themselves. So that would be a political lobbying group.
I see.
Or a political organization, not a professional organization. Our ethical guidelines make clear that we have to distinguish our role of serving as a professional expert and keep that apart from acting as a private citizen, in which case we're allowed to be involved in political activities. So what I am doing here is serving strictly as a medical consultant, but also, in a sense, as a witnessing professional who is seeing signs of danger, a threat to the public's health that the public may not be aware of. And it is in our medical ethics guidelines that we have an obligation to not just to our individual patients, but to the public as well. And it is in keeping with those guidelines that I'm voicing concerns. And the concerns are not so much about Mr. Donald Trump as a person. His personal mental health, his personal physical health are not really our affair. We're not his treating physicians. But when his capacity becomes questionable, his fitness for duty or capacity to serve becomes a question, then it is a public health issue and an issue of interest to the general public. And these are the signs that that I and thousands of mental health professionals are seeing and feel that it is our ethical obligation to speak out about it, to inform the public about it.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Bandy Lee, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine. She's a lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited, emerged. And she has an article at The Guardian, Trump is Now Dangerous, that makes his mental health a matter of public interest. But just so that I get this clear, fix up this introduction about your lobbying Capitol Hill. You haven't been on Capitol Hill or dealing with lawmakers.
I have been, right, but only at either their invitation or in the latest situation, it was through the organization of a former assistant U.S. attorney and former prosecutor. So initially what happened was I held the ethics conference, and it was a discussion about the Goldwater Rule. You may have heard of it. It's the ethical rule that says psychiatrists are not to diagnose public figures without a personal examination and without authorization. We largely agree with that. And in fact, I'm a strong proponent of the Goldwater Rule. And so we invited someone on the APA Ethics Committee to speak, but we also invited three other eminent psychiatrists, highly respected in the field, to speak about the ethics of when there might be, well, if there is a restriction on our speech because of the Goldwater Rule, would there be a situation where there would be a positive duty to speak out, such as we have in the rest of our profession? In the rest of our profession, we have restrictions such as keeping with confidentiality and consent when a patient is involved. But we also are mandated to report, to warn, and to take steps to protect potential victims when there is danger to them, when we have knowledge of danger from them, of them. And the information does not have to come to the come from the patient, but if we have any knowledge of such danger, we are obligated to take steps to protect. Now, a similar rule is not spelled out for a public figure, but whether there it would be such an instance was our question. And we believe that there is. So we have started to speak out. Again, it's not about Mr. Trump. It's about the situation of Mr. Trump being in the office of the presidency that is dangerous. We're not interested in diagnosing him. A diagnosis is a personal affair. It would follow him around even after he left the office. But the dangerousness is precisely because of the situation. And in a different situation, he may not be a danger. So that is what we're warning about. And the danger is dire, as you said, all the way up to the possibility of nuclear holocaust.
Well, let me just read a little bit of your article at The Guardian, Dr. Bandy Lee, which I think encapsulates that point that you've just made. It is Trump in the office of the presidency that poses a danger. Why? Past violence is the best predictor to future violence, and he has shown verbal aggressiveness, boasting about sexual assaults, inciting violence in others, an attraction to violence and powerful weapons, and the continual taunting of a hostile nation with nuclear weapons. Specific traits that are highly associated with violence include impulsivity, recklessness, paranoia, a loose grip on reality, and a poor understanding of consequences, rage reactions, a lack of empathy, belligerence towards others, and a constant need to demonstrate power. So this is all both exposed in the Michael Wolff book and has been exposed by everybody that's been dealing with him. And one of the most outrageous facts is that people in his own party and in the White House who deal with him on a regular basis are enablers. I did my homework and talked to a bunch of businessmen who had dealings with Donald Trump, and they told me, this was just as the campaign was beginning a couple of years back, that he exhibited these very traits that are now being exposed in this book. So my sense is that this Michael Wolff stuff is it's not too little too late, but it is too late. I hope it's not too late, I guess.
Yes, but you're right. The more time passes, the more damage gets done and the more difficult it becomes to remove the danger. And also, there's also effects on the public that are made on the public state of mental health. We know from the American Psychological Association study that we are at the poorest psychological state in memory, worse than during World War II, worse than the Vietnam War, and worse than after the September 11 terrorist attacks. And so we, as a public, are suffering, and also there can be a numbing. The mind has protection mechanisms built in, and so when it's bombarded by constant anxiety, for example, fear of some catastrophe, and also suffering from events that have already happened, the destructiveness has already happened. We're not just predicting future violence, but there is a lot that has occurred, and some of that is outlined in the editorial as well. So the more that time passes, the more damage there is going to be, and psychologically, the more difficult it will be to change the situation because we've gotten used to. We adjust ourselves. We adapt as human beings have an amazing ability to adapt to circumstances, and also, unfortunately, a consequence of that is that we also have an amazing ability to adapt to pathology, and that can be very dangerous because pathology, by definition, leads to damage, destruction, and death. instead of being life-affirming and increasing well-being and health. And so it's purely from medical, from the medical perspective and the based on the Universal Declaration of the Humanitarian Goals of Medicine that thousands of us now have come forth to warn about the dangerous situation. Again, it's not about Mr. Trump, but the dangerous situation of Mr. Trump being in the presidency.
Indeed. Well, first, do no harm. But I think you could add to what you've just said, Dr. Bandy-Lee, that we as a nation are also schizophrenic. We have an alternative universe out there with Fox News and Breitbart and Sinclair and others who are all they're talking about in the news is not the Michael Wolff book and the revelations in it, but Hillary Clinton's needing to have an inquiry into her emails yet again, and this Uranium One bogus story. So this is what I fear, and John Dean, the former, who was instrumental in the Watergate.
Yes, I know him.
Yeah,
yes,
I just
he's
wanted to
spoken
let,
before.
Right, I wanted to let the audience know who he was. He's now saying that Watergate wouldn't have happened. In other words, Nixon would not have resigned or been threatened with impeachment had we had a Fox News back then. So this is what's really troubling, is that we are, as I said earlier, you've got the mechanism the Founding Fathers gave us, but they never predicted the idea that a president of the United States would be the sole possessor and have the sole authority to launch nuclear weapons that could destroy the world.
Right. Yes, it is. It is a terrifying arrangement if you think about it. Given that any of us could, even in our best states of mind, could have lapses, and yet now we have someone who would not, perhaps have had trouble passing a fitness for duty exam. We don't know that, of course, but there are many signs showing that that could be suspect. And yet we're investing that authority without question, because as you know, there are no inhibitions or any mechanism of slowing down the steps of from ordering the nuclear weapons to launching them within minutes.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, if you don't mind, I just want to try and wrap this up in the sense that where do we go forward? Obviously, the Republican leadership is throwing their lot in with Trump, as we've seen from this conference meeting at Camp David, and the Democrats aren't in power. What can be done to accelerate this process, to stop this danger to this country and the world?
Well, unfortunately, when mental illness is involved, it's often quite difficult because it's hard to distinguish the sickness from the person. So often when the patient is quite ill, they will be the last to seek help. In fact, they will do everything possible not to seek it. And that's why all 50 states of the U.S. allow for health professionals to be able to detain those who are suffering from mental illness if they're refusing treatment and they are a danger. So the further we fall into illness, and it is interesting that you brought up some media mechanisms, the propaganda and the conspiracy theories. Those are enabling of the pathological situation because they allow people to hold on to conspiracy theories or what would more appropriately be delusions or fixed false beliefs. And that is a pathological condition. So you are correct in that we have conditions in society that facilitate illness and enable the illness. Also, the party structure, one has said, is allowing for that to be more possible. So in any case, many illnesses are also environment-induced as well as generating from within the individual. And so the the solution is to quickly remove the pathogenic condition, the pathology producing condition. And in this case, you know, removing the dangerous condition. What we generally do with a dangerous individual is we contain them, we remove them from access to weapons, and we do an urgent evaluation. And basically, that is what we're calling for from a medical standpoint. It doesn't have to do with politics. It just happens to be in the political realm. But these are, this is a medical standard of care. And, well, in the president's case, he is a public figure and therefore influential publicly, and therefore will have public health effects. And therefore, signs of his incapacity are very concerning. We don't know that he's incapacitated or incompetent. That will only come with a full evaluation. But we're already seeing a lot of signs. In addition to the dangerousness that you've mentioned, I also mentioned cognitive function, which many people have already noted widely. The change in his cognitive abilities, the ability to complete a sentence, to stick with an idea, to use complex vocabulary, and to not make loose associations. And we're seeing, in comparing his speeches over time, we're seeing a marked decline. And so so I am in a public position of witnessing, educating to the public. And so I do not take upon myself the role to advise the White House physician, but my hope is that the physician will be able to see the need for a neuropsychiatric evaluation as well as a capacity exam, a capacity to serve exam.
Well, Dr. Bandili, I thank you very much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Bandili, who's a forensic psychiatrist on the faculty of Yale School of Medicine. She is the lead organizer of the Duty to Warn conference at Yale University, out of which the best-selling book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President, which she edited, emerged. And she has an article at The Guardian, Trump is Now Dangerous, that makes his mental health a matter of public interest. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into whether Trump is possibly blackmailing Lindsey Graham using information the Russians hacked from the RNC and the senator's private email. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. You have, girl. Don't you know you gotta tell the truth, yeah. Baby, why don't you tell me the truth now? You know you got me going, everything crazy that you want me to do. Yes, you have, yeah. Watch it. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sarah Kendzior, who is a journalist who covers U.S. and international politics. She has a PhD in anthropology and specializes in the authoritarian states of Central Asia, and is the author of the essay collection The View from Flyover Country. She's currently an op-ed columnist for the Toronto Globe and Mail, where she focuses on U.S. politics. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sarah Kendzior.
Oh, thank you for having me.
And you were on MSNBC a few days ago, I noticed you, and you raised the question of whether or not it's possible that Senator Lindsey Graham is being blackmailed, presumably by Donald Trump. And there's no question that Senator Lindsey Graham has done an about-face from being an acerbic critic of Donald Trump to a gushing sycophant. So what do you think happened?
You know, there are a lot of plausible explanations. I mean, first, you shouldn't rule out the most obvious things, which are greed, careerism, opportunism, things we've always seen in politics. But the fact that last year Graham was one of the people who initiated, you know, the call for an investigation of Trump's ties to Russia, and also was somebody who called him out repeatedly on his mental instability, is now, you know, gone the opposite way, defending him, promoting his golf course, is alarming. And it's in the context of this broader GOP obsequiousness toward Trump, where they just gather around a table and salute the dear leader. So I think there's a few possibilities. One of them is blackmail. We know that Graham's personal email was hacked last year. He said this. We know that the RNC was hacked and that, you know, we don't know what happened to those emails or, you know, who is in possession with them. It's possible he's being threatened. Trump, throughout his career, has, you know, threatened people he sees as rivals. He's often employed a team of lawyers to do this. We saw this as recently as, as the campaign itself. And so, you know, the main thing I see when I look at him is just, you know, this abrupt about face and a kind of reaction of fear. And I see that throughout the GOP. And that's what makes me think that the explanation for this is not as simple as just the kind of standard opportunism, you know, we see in politics, but something a bit more nefarious.
Well, Lindsey Graham himself has said that his emails were hacked by the Russians. And as you mentioned, the RNC's emails were hacked also by the Russians along with the DNC, but the Russians clearly decided to pass on the DNC information to WikiLeaks and not the RNC. But that doesn't mean that the FSB and the GRU haven't gone through these emails with a fine-tooth comb. So is that the possibility that you're raising, in effect, that the Russians are the source of the blackmail or have the blackmail material?
I mean, that's certainly a possibility. I think that they're one possible source of this. But we've also seen Trump himself, you know, and his team carry out these kinds of blackmail or threat operations, you know, which sometimes extend to threats towards people's children, towards people's loved ones, without Russian assistance. And so I think what we have here are two groups of people, the Trump camp and, you know, people associated with the Kremlin, that both, you know, act in the same way and carry out the same kind of goals. And if they can collaborate, which they did throughout the 2016 campaign, then it's more effective. So I think it's possible that someone on Trump's team may have possession of these emails that, you know, were taken possibly from Russia and has been using them in order to have political gain.
Well, I've talked to intelligence sources who told me that the Russians are still active, and that there's a concern that not only has Donald Trump done nothing about the Russians, he denies that they did anything at all, but the Congress, the Republicans, have not done anything. And in fact, Lindsey Graham has led the charge not to protect our next election in November of this year and in 2020, but he's led the charge to try and discredit Christopher Steele of the notorious Steele dossier. So is it possible that, in fact, the Republicans are keeping the Russians around to help them out? They helped them out clearly in 2016. Are they going to help them out in 2018 and 2020?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely possible, and I agree with that assessment that their operations are ongoing. There hasn't been anything to curtail them. Trump's proposed solution was a joint cybersecurity commission with Putin, so basically aligning ourselves with a hostile state that's hacked us. And I think that's going to be a really big issue in the 2018 midterms. And the fact that someone like Graham, you know, who was so consistently alarmed by this situation a year ago, has now flipped, you know, as you're insinuating, you know, indicates that he may be fearful of what kind of revelations could potentially emerge from these emails, whether about him, whether about the GOP as a whole, or whether about, you know, other more external threats. You know, that kind of thing is difficult to say.
So there is also, of course, there have been for the longest time innuendos about the sexuality of Senator Graham. Mike Huckabee is one. He's, of course, a prominent GOP person, along with his daughter, who's now the White House spokesperson. But I'm not suggesting she said anything, but Huckabee's made some insinuations to that effect. And I've spoken to journalists down in South Carolina, and it's been sort of routine in elections, but none of these smears have ever stuck. And Lindsey Graham is up for re-election in 2020. So could there be, aside from the kind of tabloid nature of some of these questions. Could there be a simpler explanation that Lindsey Graham sees the writing on the wall, that the Republican Party is now controlled by the Tea Party, if not by extension the Koch brothers, and therefore he's got to repair the damage he's done in the eyes of these zealots who control the primary process in the Republican Party?
I mean, that's possible, but there are many ways one could go about doing that. Like, if you wanted to aid Trump's objectives, aid the Republicans, keep them in office, I think he wouldn't be doing something as dramatic as promoting Trump's golf course on Twitter or, you know, directly contradicting statements that he made a year ago. I think he'd play it a little cooler and a little quieter. And, you know, the fact that he acts as if he's, you know, not acting on his own accord, you know, is what concerns me.
So is there something going on at the broadest level here? Because when we talk about the about face of Lindsey Graham, it also appears to be across the board. It's as though the Republican Party has decided to throw their lot in with Trump, despite the revelations in this new book that has got everybody's attention, the Michael Wolff book. They're rallying around him. They had a big meeting up at Camp David. The conspicuous absence there was, of course, the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, which has led to speculation that maybe his days are numbered, and by extension, the Mueller investigation's days are numbered. But what's your sense is, have they really decided to double down and support Trump for whatever reasons?
I'm not sure it's something they decided as much as they weighed a number of very bad options and are trying to pick the one that will result in the least personal damage to themselves. I think this is also why we've seen a number of GOP representatives stepping down or saying they're not going to run in future elections. Because when they elected Trump, I think everyone was aware of the kind of, you know, quote-unquote revelations from Michael Wolff's book, you know, of his emotional volatility, of his complete ignorance on policy, of the fact that he wasn't particularly interested in governing as much as he was just interested in ruling. I think they knew that. I'm not sure everybody was as aware of the Russian ties, of other, you know, possible crimes that he's committed, whether in the past or ongoing in office, and that he would be so flagrant in committing them, that he would, you know, just kind of lay it out there. He hasn't been subtle about this. You know, he gave state secrets to Russian officials in the White House. And so you would think that that would be kind of a big wake-up call. That would be something that would get everybody to unite and say, you know, this is a question of sovereignty. This is a question of national security. We need to work together. But instead, you know, as you said, they basically are working for Trump. They're trying to obstruct the investigation. They're trying to cover it up. They're trying to abet him. And that, to me, implies that there's a kind of contamination going on. You know, they threw their lot in with him in the beginning, and there's no real way to get out unharmed, whether it's, you know, taking dirty money, which is another thing that happened with Senator Graham and other senators, where they took money from Russian oligarchs who are now implicated in the Mueller probe, or, you know, just illicit meetings, you know, all kinds of things. And so, you know, I'm not sure they're choosing this as much as they're backed into a corner. And if they had integrity, I think that they would just speak the truth and support the investigation, regardless of those political consequences, because there's more at stake than, you know, just their own lives.
Well, you have a column about kleptocratic authoritarians, and that has been a description also of Trump and his family. So it would seem to me that the calculus here is, amongst the Republicans, is do we cut this kleptocrat loose now, who could well be a Russian traitor, or do we stick with him in the hope that we can contain, sabotage, or even end the Mueller inquiry before 2018, before November 2018? Is that their calculus, that they, because they are throwing their lot in to destroy the Mueller investigation or to sabotage from within? It's not, I think it's quite likely that Sessions will be fired and they'll go after Mueller, or they can sabotage Mueller from within the DOJ. They're already doing that, as a matter of fact. There's a purge underway at the FBI. They now have access to all of the personal data of FBI agents, their texts, their emails, etc., looking for pro-Democrat FBI agents, and although clearly the majority of FBI agents are Republicans, as are, of course, both Mueller and Comey. So it seems to be underway, isn't it, the purge and the attacks on the DOJ. Fox is round the clock beating the drum that essentially, and Trump himself, of course, calls the DOJ the deep state DOJ. So they're all in collusion, aren't they?
Essentially, yeah, and it's become progressively worse as the years gone on. I think immediately after Comey was fired, those who were kind of hanging on to this hope that the whole thing was, you know, overstated or exaggerating, you know, had to realize that, you know, yes, this is real, and Trump is trying to obstruct the investigation. He admitted he was trying to obstruct it on national TV to Lester Holt, and, you know, one would think that would have been the end of the line, you know, and Congress would have made some move then. But they're not. And then as time has gone on, you know, they've become, the GOP has become unable to deny any of this. So they're trying to flip it and recast the people who are investigating as the actual villains. In this case, the FBI and, you know, certain people in the DOJ, not Sessions so much because, you know, he's in on this, you know, as well as Democrats, as Christopher Steele or anybody who's raised criticism and has, you know, vouched for this inquiry is now being labeled as unpatriotic and unreliable and so forth. And yeah, you know, that is the kind of thing you see in an authoritarian state, but more in, you know, a kind of a democracy that's transitioning into something worse, which is really where I think we are. You know, we're obviously not an authoritarian state, or I wouldn't be, you know, having this conversation with you on the phone, just casually talking about it. But I do think that we are transitioning to an autocracy. I think we have been for the last year. And this attack on the independence of institutions like the FBI and the DOJ, you know, is part of that. And the fact that the Republicans do not seem willing to serve the Constitution, to serve the public, or even, to some respect, serve themselves, because a lot of them are, you know, really hurting their reputations and their careers by doing this, is a real, you know, it's a thing that makes me wonder, because they seem very dedicated to serving Trump, even if they've held him in contempt, even if Trump has openly threatened them or humiliated him, they still are serving him. And that's the kind of thing, you know, you really tend to see in a dictatorship. And, you know, it's alarming. It should alarm the American people.
Well, what's alarming about authoritarians is that once you get in, they get into power, they don't give up power, and it's hard to pry them out. And if we see, for example, the Arab Spring, they tried to get rid of a whole bunch of them, and look what's happened. And Trump has certainly not reached the level of Putin or Erdogan, even although he admires all of these kleptocrats and dictators. But the real question would be, I mean, first of all, the other day he said, "Where's my Roy Cohn?" If that's not an example of somebody's outlook in terms of thuggery and blackmail and ruthlessness in politics, you know, Roy Cohn was a poster boy. He represented the Gottis and all these mobsters. And Trump apparently has some kind of affection for mobsters and to some extent sees himself as a kind of godfather. And of course, if you're in New York real estate, you certainly occasionally rub shoulders with the mob. And he's certainly been in business with Felix Sater, who's mobbed up beyond belief. So is that the connection here that we should be concerned about, the idea that that this guy has flagrant authoritarian tendencies and he doesn't play by anybody's rule book? He plays by the Roy Cohn rule book, and maybe all of us are flat-footed here. I mean, the idea that everybody says, oh, if he gets rid of Mueller, people are going to rise up. Well, I'm not sure that in the middle of winter you're going to have the streets of America full enough people to drive this guy out of the White House.
Yeah, I'm not sure that that would necessarily be effective. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up Roy Cohn for a couple of reasons. First, the mafia ties, you know, that you brought up. Roy Cohn was somebody who defended the mafia. And, you know, Trump isn't just somebody who admires the mob from a distance. He's somebody who's had relationships with both American mobsters and Russian mobsters, you know, all of whom, not all of the mobsters, you know, there have been from both of those groups, people who have been investing in his properties and basically keeping him afloat when U.S. banks wouldn't lend money or he ran into other obstacles. And the other significance of Roy Cohn is that he's somebody who is deeply enmeshed in GOP politics. You know, he worked for McCarthy, he worked for Nixon, and then was a consultant, you know, until his death in, you know, I think 1984. And he was also the person who introduced Trump to Paul Manafort and Roger Stone. And there's this big myth that's put out there, especially by the GOP, that Trump is some kind of of political neophyte, that he just doesn't understand how things work, that he's not possibly capable of, you know, being involved in some sort of, you know, high-profile criminal politics. But that's, in fact, the world that he's been in, you know, for 30 years. And he's had political ambitions for 30 years. You know, the first time he thought about running for president was 1988. And then, you know, he ran briefly in 2000, and then again in 2012, and again in 2016. And so, you know, when he's doing stuff like tweeting yesterday that, you know, he won on his first try, that's not true, but it's meant to put forth this idea that he's somehow less conniving and more innocent than he seems. And I'm not going to say he's some sort of strategic mastermind. I think this is very obviously, you know, a group effort. And that's the way that Trump has led his whole life. He's always had, you know, powerful lawyers and backers working in the shadows to protect him and his brand and his family. And that mentality, you know, which is itself a mafia mentality, is what remains today. And it's why we have all these shady characters occupying the White House, flagrantly committing violations and not being removed from power, even though the evidence is often in the public domain.
Well, Sarah Kensinger, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Sarah Kensinger, who is a journalist who covers U.S. and international politics. She has a PhD in anthropology and specializes in the authoritarian states of Central Asia, and is the author of the essay collection The View from Flyover Country, and is currently an op-ed columnist for the Toronto Globe and Mail, where she focuses on U.S. politics. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into how Speaker Paul Ryan is clearly in collusion with Donald Trump, having given Devin Nunes permission to rifle through the Mueller investigation and essentially scuttle it.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way of saying goodbye. I learned a good way.
Good way.
I learned a good way.
Good way.
You taught me everything I know about taking other people for a ride. And I just wanted to take the time to thank you for that gift tonight.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Scott Horton, a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Horton.
Great to be with you, Ian.
Well, thank you, Scott. And just following the discussion about the influence of Roy Cohn over Donald Trump, and it was revealed recently by the New York Times that when Trump was furious with Attorney General Sessions for not recusing himself, he screamed out, "Where's my Roy Cohn?" Now, I think that maybe the liberals and progressives and the Democrats in this country are a little delusional, and everybody's sort of, I know that that Schumer and Pelosi have instructed the rank and file not to sort of crow about this Michael Wolff book and to stay out of it, and in the hope that Donald Trump self-destructs. I think that's an absolutely, vain and pathetic wish. This guy is ruthless. He's doing stuff that no other president's done. He's got no moral compunctions, nothing impeding him in any way. He's thoroughly brazen. He's capable of doing so much more damage. And I think, again, the opposition in this country, at least the political opposition, not the people, but the political opposition, continues to underestimate him.
Well, I agree with that. I mean, I think if you can go back to the campaign period, and continue afterwards, and when you look at who he views as admirable leaders in the world today, and I guess we had three figures in particular who were cited over and over again. And, you know, most U.S. presidents would cite, other allied leaders. Not so Trump. He seems to have a dismissive attitude towards just about all our allies, but he was only complimentary of Vladimir Putin, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and President Xi in China. So three highly autocratic rulers who rule over a system that is, compared to the United States, much more monolithic, where power is aggregated at the top. And it's very, very clear that that's what he wants. And I think the comment about Roy Cohn is extremely revealing. So it reveals his attitude towards the Department of Justice. The Justice Department and the machinery of criminal justice in the country are there to protect him and terrorize his adversaries. And I think we've seen that, you know, certainly in his conflict with Sessions over Sessions' non-recusal, but also in the decision to reinstitute criminal investigations looking into Hillary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation. And in both cases, these things started after he made public statements demanding that they happen. So it looks very much like they've been directed by the president. And if you go back and you look at the famous speech that Robert Jackson, maybe the most famous of all U.S. attorney generals, gave, called the federal prosecutor, he says in that speech that this is what the entire system must be arranged to prevent, a system in which the president, the executive at the top, is directing criminal prosecutions of political adversaries. That may not happen, and yet that appears to be what is happening. And most people seem to just accept it.
Well, but it's gotten worse because the Speaker Ryan and the Republicans, as we see from this meeting at Camp David, they're all in on it. Ryan, in spite of pleadings from the Deputy Attorney General, Rob Rosenstein, has gone ahead and given Devin Nunes permission to snoop on the inquiry and to go after the FBI in ways that are extraordinary. You wonder whether there's any civil service protection for FBI agents now, because Nunes is going to be able to look into every FBI agent's private email and texting to find out whether they're so-called Democrat sympathizers, so to purge the FBI. And Trump, of course, has called the DOJ the Deep State Department of Justice. The writing's on the wall here. They're all in on it.
I think that's right. I think what happened with Devin Nunes and Ryan this last week was also shocking. I worked with the House Judiciary Committee about 7 years ago in hearings that were a review of pending criminal matters. And I remember dealing extensively with the U.S. Department of Justice on that, and Justice Department steadfastly refusing to turn over any materials relating either to a currently open or to a recently closed criminal case. And I know when that happened, I thought their position was rather extreme, and I looked at it and I saw, no, that has been the historical position at least for the last 90 years. Very, very well set out. So as far as I know, what was just done and what was just agreed to would be a first in the history of the Department of Justice, that they turn over materials to a congressional investigator of an open and pending criminal investigation. That's never happened before. And they turned over the materials to Devin Nunes, who was, in fact, a member of the Trump transition team. And, of course, the conduct of the Trump transition team is right squarely at the focus of the criminal investigation. So they've turned over materials concerning a pending criminal investigation to a person who is clearly a person of interest in the investigation. That's also just mind-boggling.
But to my mind, the real, there's a lot of villains in this story, obviously, and we don't know how bad it is, although it does seem as though, you know, at the end of the day, we could learn, if this guy doesn't blow us up and have a nuclear tantrum, that we might well find out that he's as I often say, rather crudely, Putin's bitch. The other villain, though, is just absolutely up there in the pantheon of evil, is Rupert Murdoch. We know from the Wolf book that Murdoch privately thinks Trump is an idiot, like apparently most people who deal with him. But he's out there throwing his entire lot in. His junkyard dogs on Fox News are just working propaganda overtime, recasting James Comey and Robert Mueller as enemies of the state, and the DOJ as the deep state, and the FBI riddled with Hillary Clinton partisans, and all this insanity that they're doing. And at the end of the day, Scott, I don't think we'll have a civil war in this country, but we could have real civil unrest unless Mueller, and assuming he can get the damn investigation done, unless he really has unbelievably overwhelming evidence that anybody and everybody in this country could accept as the truth. The Fox and Murdoch have created a condition in which these people, these, 30% of the country, which happens to be heavily armed, they will not believe that Trump is guilty, and they will take to the streets, and this will be, the blood will be on Murdoch's hands.
Well, that's putting it in the most extreme sense, but, you know, I think it's justified. And in fact, what you say is what people like Roger Stone repeatedly threaten. I mean, the threat that he's constantly saying, you know, no evidence will be good and persuasive evidence as far as we're concerned. We will doubt anything that comes from the FBI, the Department of Justice, because they're against us. And, we're armed and we'll battle to the end. So this is the sort of rhetoric we get of violence. And, of course, if we go back and we look at, you know, going back to the beginning of all this, which is, viewing this all as part of a Russian intelligence campaign to fracture society. I mean, this was their objective. I mean, it was not really to install candidate A over candidate B in the presidency. It was to identify and exploit fissures within the body politic of the country that would disable the country politically, and therefore weaken it and make it no longer be a meaningful adversary to Russia. And I think this is how you would see that entire plan fulfilled in the end of the day.
Well, in an interview in Politico, John Dean of Watergate fame said that Nixon probably wouldn't have been impeached or had resigned if Fox News was operating back in those days. So I think that kind of makes the point I'm trying to make here, that that this is, I find, the scary part is that it's... Hard to get a consensus in this country about what is real and what is true. And I live on the west side of Los Angeles, so I'm in ground zero of a bunch of liberals living in the MSNBC bubble. But I think you've really got to make an effort to watch Fox News every now and then as you switch channels from MSNBC to Fox News, and you'll find out that they're not talking about the Wolf book. They're talking about Uranium One and... the Clinton Foundation and Hillary Clinton's emails. That's all they're talking about.
I think that's right. I think when you saw the first bits of the Wolf book appear in The Guardian and then The Hollywood Reporter, it was absolutely dominant on every cable news network in the country except one, and that was Rupert Murdoch's. And Rupert Murdoch only picked it up a little bit later, and then it picked it up with sort of biting sarcasm and criticism, not reporting what was covered by it. I can recall now about 4 months ago talking with a very well-known UK columnist for Rupert Murdoch's flagship publication, who told me that he knew from talking to Murdoch that Murdoch spoke with Trump virtually every day, those were the words he used, and that what they were doing was planning the day's media message to use to combat criticism. So that's Murdoch personally talking to Trump every day to do this, and then you would see whatever they agreed on as their tactic for the following day, you'd see that implemented across the board throughout the entire Murdoch media empire, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Post and Fox News Network and so forth. And you see what a powerful punch that packs, particularly with the, roughly 35% who support Trump, which is, you know, essentially coincident with the people who watch Fox.
So I'm not wrong, Scott, in casting Rupert Murdoch as the most malignant and damaging export from Australia since they mixed kangaroo meat in with hamburger meat in, back in the 1960s.
Well, I would say, to be a little bit less judgmental, perhaps you could say the most politically powerful, no doubt about that. And I think, you know, that political power was wielded first in the UK, and now it's being wielded, you know, consequently and much more powerfully in the United States.
So just in the last couple of minutes, how do we get out of this mess? I started out with Dr. Bandy Lee, the Yale psychiatrist, who it was explaining that this is now a public health matter. The stuff in the Wolf book, you know, it's one thing, you know, people are entitled, including Trump, entitled to privacy when it comes to his medical matters. But when you're president of the United States and you behave like this, it becomes a public health issue for all, affects all of us. And at the end of the day, we have the possibility of an unstable man in the White House igniting a nuclear war. And as the Nobel laureate for the, this year's Peace Prize said, we are one tantrum away from a nuclear war. So the this is the dire situation, and we've been talking about the politics of it. Dr. Lee was telling us, giving us the psychological cold shower about the reality of what's going on. How do we get out of this mess? Because I don't see the Democrats doing anything, and the Republicans are being disgusting, and they're doubling down, supporting Trump, throwing their lot in with him. So how do we get out of this mess?
Yeah, it's not. There's no obvious escape hatch for us that I can see. Certainly not before the 2018 elections and the installment installation of a new Congress. I think previously we had a very difficult relationship between Trump and Mitch McConnell, and an unclear relationship between him and Paul Ryan, and that gave some reason to suspect that the congressional leadership would be a break. I think as of this weekend in the summit that they've arranged at Camp David, and things like the 180-degree flip by Lindsey Graham, you have to dismiss that as a possibility. It's pretty clear at this point that Trump has reconciled to the congressional leadership. They've committed to support him, and that commitment includes an all-out attack on Mueller. And I think we saw the first volley with this attack on Christopher Steele, and what I expect is going to happen over the course of the next week, the next couple of weeks, are probably going to be more rounds fired at Christopher Steele and Fusion GPS and an attempt to suggest that they're the basis for the whole probe, which of course isn't true. But it'll be a disinformation campaign designed to bolster the position of Trump and disparage and undermine confidence in the FBI, the Department of Justice, and Bob Mueller. And I think the critics of Trump are going to have to fire back with all they've got.
Well, Scott Horton, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure.
And again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, who's a professor at Columbia Law School and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. He serves on the American branch of the International Law Association and has represented a variety of journalists and whistleblowers. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.